Well, I'm delighted and honoured to be here today to share with you some insights and some information, and more importantly, some thinking and some questions from our distinguished, diverse, informed and insightful panel. Please, as we go through the panel interview and some of the questions, start to think of your own questions or thoughts that you'd like to place to the panel, because there will be some time at the end for you to raise those and get those answers. So on this topic, which of course, as we've already heard, is incredibly important and particularly prominent in our state, as well as nationally and internationally, I thought I'd open it up by asking the panel some of their personal insights and perspectives on the broader topic of justice reinvestment. So first I'll ask Zoe.
Thank you. It's an honour to be here today. Thank you, Ray. Thank you, Sita. I'm representing Women's Legal Service of Western Australia, particularly given it is the 16 days to stop violence against women in WA. I actually thought, having seen that video, that I might start off by sharing with you some details about what a female prisoner in a WA jail typically looks like from a background perspective. Really ties into that Our Watch video in terms of the impact of family and domestic violence. So she's typically come from an impoverished background. She suffered trauma and probably abuse as a child. As an adult, she's been in a family and domestic violence situation. That's been witnessed by her children, as we've seen in the video. For the most part, she's probably in jail for quite minor offences. She's lost contact with her children, or she's fighting to try and retain some contact with those children. She has no financial security, and on her release, she has very limited options, resafe housing. That really concerns us at Women's Legal, and we do believe, as shared by the Honourable Robert Mazar, that the strategy of justice reinvestment can actually address some of these known problems. Because it is a vicious cycle where her children are experiencing this and their path is already created. So for us, as the only gender-specific, culturally informed, trauma-informed legal service for women in WA, we really do believe in the power of early intervention and prevention. And we want to empower women and help women be empowered by providing them with the holistic services we know they need and their children need to avoid ending up in the prison system.
Thank you, Zoe. Devon, can I get your personal perspective on this?
Thanks, Ray. I'd like to thank Sita, Paula. We go back a few years now. I've humbugged a little bit around this space, but with justice reinvestment, I'd like to thank Serco and KPMG also. Thank you very much, and the guests, honoured guests, and ladies and gentlemen. I normally start proceedings simply by saying that I'm the son of a father, who's the son of a father, and it's three generations of men that used violence. And I was one of those children that Zoe was referring to. And it was normal in my family, in my community, actually, and just in families, but extended families, just remembering that we're not just a nuclear family in our communities, we are extended families. So all of my uncles and all of my aunties are my mums, and that's my dads and my uncles. And they're all our role models. And look, it got to a point where when I was a young person, that I lost my innocence as a child, being the eldest in our community is also a rite of passage. I'm have got a title as Burunga, which is the eldest grandson, nephew, son, whatever it is. It's the oldest in the whole in the entire family. So I live between two worlds: the older generation of me, and then we've got the younger generation under me. The old people come to see me for all the goings on and all the shenanigans with the younger generation, and vice versa. And so I'm a message stick between both worlds. And in that too, there's me. So I grew up with family violence, witnessing family violence. I was the dynamics of family violence is not just talked about a lot in public forums like this, but the dynamics of family violence is, for children in particular, is that we become invisible. And for many years I was invisible. And growing up, I lost my voice to be able to speak out against violence and about what was happening in my family. And I grew up in a generation, of course, 20, 30 years ago, where violence wasn't spoken about at all. And so what you had as a result was you had to act out. So there's a whole generation of men that acted out from witnessing violence as children. So, and there's a title they call that today, it's a generation of trauma. You add to that also intergenerational trauma with colonisation and the loss of a way of life and culture, which impacts the whole of the family setting, goes on and on and on. Then there's alcohol and all the rest of it. So in my family right now, as an example, I'd be one of the very few in my family that abstain from the use of violence, abstain from alcohol and the misuse of alcohol and drugs, as an example. And I have stayed out of being incarcerated all for about approximately, I won't get into exact details, but 20 years now. And in that process, I thought things would change, others would follow, one leads in the family, others would follow. It didn't happen like that, unfortunately, for me in my family. And I got to a point where I said, well, something's got to change. Something's got to be put there on the ground, tangible, to help change this process, rather than each individual going on their own individual journeys and healing pathways, like I did, because it takes too long. And our women and children can't afford that in our communities. So it came about that we had it in front of us all the time. There was women's refuges and the refuge movement. And I thought, that's it. Why is it then that women in a violent situation have to flee to access these refuge centres and become homeless and victimised all over again so many times in so many different ways? And yet men who are the men that use violence and that are the perpetrators are given a 72-hour order or whatever. The police intervene at the cold face and they're charged and they wait for the outcome, sort of thing. The outcome doesn't wait for the women that's happened. It's happened. And it will continue to happen from that point onwards, and has for many, goodness knows how long. So it should be that the men, we thought, should be removed from the home using the same existing model with women's refuge. And then you remove the man who's the perpetrator, and you're making him accountable and responsible instantly for his actions. And the police should have that option as well, to rather than just issue an order, 72 hours removal or whatever it is today, which then of course always leads to a punitive process with the perpetrator, and of course leads to the higher incarceration rate of Aboriginal men. Then there's the other end of that, where the men come out and there's no indication if that man is a perpetrator for the next partner in his life. And whether it's the same partner, and then all the phases that you know, we, all the titles, the honeymoon phase, all the rest of it, the promises, the broken promises, everything else. And then there's either the next partner. She won't, the next partner will not even listen to the ex-partner, as an example. It becomes a case of, well, you're just jealous. So it's jealousy, and that's huge in our communities, is jealousy. So the whole process happens again and again, so repetitive, so cyclical, it's something needs to be done about it. And that's where we said, well, if we have a service provider like a centre where you can, the judges, the magistrates have an opportunity to be able to send this particular perpetrator that's in front of the magistrate and have that option, say, well, you've got a space, safe space, because as long as he's safe, we believe, then his family's safe. Because he's a manipulator, master manipulator, and he's unpredictable. Ask the police officer when he goes in, one of the worst crimes that an officer would be called to is a domestic call-out. Because it's so unpredictable. They don't know the outcome of it. And that's, there is no data on that either, because it's so difficult from where I stand to even collect any data on how many violent perpetrators there are. We don't have that data because it's criminalised. So they're locked up for assault, common assault, grievous bodily harm, etc., etc. The laws have changed, so I have read of recent, so it's in state parliament now and they're talking about changing that process. But they sort of kick in. So there's many that come together for the Abbey Miles Healing Centre. Some of them are sitting in the crowd today, which I acknowledge, that team of ours. And none of us are paid to do this either. None of us get any monetary reward. We've done what we've done, and you have all the books in front of you that I left a handout there, etc. And so I've just been asked to wind it up. Ben, you know you like to be a storyteller. So I can go on and on. So that's where I am. Ray has developed an outcome like Robert said, around domestic violence. Because of domestic violence, because I know it, I grew up with it, I was it, I'm no longer it, and we have to stop it. And domestic violence, as a perpetrator, stops with me. And so it should with all of
you. Thank you. Thanks, Kevin, for that insightful and passionate sharing of your project, which people haven't collected. There's some literature out of the desk that you can take away and find out more. Having heard from two of the most vulnerable at-risk groups, being females and Indigenous people, let's hear now from some of our panel who are actually in the justice system and get some of their perspectives. So maybe I could start with Lana, if you could share some of your thoughts.
Sure, thank you. Is that all? Yeah. Stu, I have to go off with Devon. Sorry, everybody, it'll dance. We're not going to move you as much. Thank you to everybody. Thank you for coming today. To echo Devon's thank yous, the long list of them, truly humbled that so many people from such diverse walks of life are in the room today, because we're not going to do this alone. Yes, I am in the justice sector. However, it's going to require a collective effort, and that's going to be a cross-sector way of doing things differently. Full disclosure, I'd also like to, if it's okay, thank our First Nations people who are in the room today and the traditional custodians of the land. But I also like to put it out there when I go to justice-oriented events/conferences and thank anybody for being brave enough to come into the room today and be part of a conversation if you yourself have endured the criminal justice system and potentially being affected by it. We need you. We need you to have a voice in this movement. To that end, as I said, full disclosure, I myself was a perpetrator of crime. And I say that unashamedly, and I will call myself a perpetrator, albeit it was many, many years ago, and I do all I can to give back to the community what I took from it. But what is worth calling out, to echo what Zoe has stated, and partially what Devon has said, is a contributing factor to a very young teenage girl who ended up incarcerated, as I did, and that is the overrepresentation of the women who are abused as children and beyond, who find themselves at a point where there's a very thin line between being a victim of crime and then deemed a perpetrator of it. I myself, it is the reason that I wake up in the morning and I work for the likes of Serco, and I will always have an invested interest in the criminal justice system. What I'm more passionate about when it comes to the specific nature of this event today is the fact that I was one of the lucky ones, and I was afforded an opportunity to participate in the diversion program. So I was one of the little lucky young women who, for whatever reason, sat in a cell for not too long, and then I was afforded the opportunity to reapply for bail. And at the front end of my journey, focus on all of the underlying issues as to how it came to be that I ended up a chronic substance abuser and subsequently a criminal. Now, I have all of those lessons learned in my personal life, and it's not just about me. That was just disclosure of why I'm here today. There are so many cohorts and so many target groups that we really need to be co-designing models for. Yes, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population. Yes, you know, the battered and abused women. But at the end of the day, people are people. And for working right now, you know, I was the CEO of a charity for a very long time, but right now, wearing the Serco hat, we are one of the world's, and actually Australia's largest prison operator. I can't tell you for the last 3 years how many times I walk into our correctional facilities. And my colleagues who wear the uniform say to me, Lana, we've got to do something about it. We've got to stop turning the key at night on people that just should not be here. You know, it doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter how many not-for-profits we invite in here. We're doing a pretty good job, but it's an uphill battle. And why were they sent here in the first place? And everybody in this room knows those types of people that should not be sent to prison. It's socially and economically insane. It just does not make sense. So what we did, probably about 12 months ago now, I was the director of rehabilitation in a conventional custodial context. And that's what I have done for the last 15 years. And it was 1 year ago, I didn't knock, I banged on the CEO's door. And I said, as the leading prison operator across Australia and afar, we need to create alternatives to custody. And that's got to be with the community and in the community because, as Judge said, prisons are prisons and they are always going to be there. And I am not in any way saying, as a mother of a 7-year-old child, to abolish the prison sector, because it is a place where some people need to go. In saying that, we can avoid some people being in that bed, and it's not to say we're going to burn prisons down tomorrow or even start closing them one by one, because if one body is taken out, sure as hell, within our lifetime, there's going to be another body in it, and it is what it is. But that's not the conversation today. The conversation that I took to my CEO was, can we start a dialogue and get rubber on the road at the same time, because we have talked a lot in this country for a very, very long time. So I got the yes, believe it or not, I didn't get fired. And we did, as Wendy introduced earlier, and that's how we crossed paths about a year ago, we created a dedicated practice known as Serco Asia Pacific's Alternative Justice Practice. And that's what I direct, and that team is growing and evolving quicker than I can keep up with, which is the best thing that I can say to you today. I'll speak maybe a little bit later for anyone who cares to listen about two of the programs that we have formally co-developed. We've started with the New South Wales government, and next stop is Western Australia, and I'm really, really excited to say that because we run Acacia Prison and we don't want everybody ending up in Acacia Prison because of the lack of alternatives. So the way in which we're actively and proactively messaging to any form of government and I suppose branch of community that would like to play a part in this
is it's got to be sincerely co-designed and co-delivered from the get-go. Unashamedly, I will sit here and tell you today, Serco know their place, and Serco's place in the alternative justice space is not Serco's place in a conventional custodial contract whereby we manage it, and not-for-profits. So much as we can, and we do a damn good job, and that's why I work for Serco, we do welcome, we're very inclusive. We welcome in the not-for-profit sector and the local elders and the family and everybody into our prisons, but we're going to flip that narrative in the NJ space, in the alternative justice space. And that means we're happy to sit there and say, we'll deal with the bureaucracy, we will deal with all of the side of contracting that are creating barriers for you as the frontline service providers. And some of the models that we've put together excite us and excite our community partners and excite those with lived experience who have sat in the workshops with us, and also excite government because they're dealing with an intermediary where they can say, Serco, if you'd like to manage it, that would be great. But the voice has come from the community sector, whereby I've had a CEO of a not-for-profit in New South Wales look a minister in the eye when the minister said, but you're proposed to be the frontline service provider in this model that will divert a young offender from prison through holistic rehabilitation, including a residential component. If you're doing the essence of the frontline service delivery, why is Lana Santos in the room representing Serco? And I'm not going to lie, I went, oh God, where is this going? And I just went red and felt that I should leave the room. And respectfully, it was the Aboriginal CEO of the Aboriginal-oriented not-for-profit service provider who said, I wouldn't do it alone. I have been battling with funding constraints and the competition in the not-for-profit sector, and if that mob right there will integrate the best of the best and recognise the pockets of excellence that exist across six organisations and pluck and integrate and facilitate and allow us to have a caseload of 30 instead of 20, because we're not getting bogged down in all of the other stuff, the behind-the-scenes stuff, and that's why we're doing it, and we won't do it without them. That's not to put tickets on ourselves, and that's not why I tell that story. That is just to let you know that we don't want to do everything. We want a strengths-based approach from here on, and I think slowly but surely, with ongoing analysis and the ability to scale, we can not potentially close down prisons, as I said, but we can actually make a real social and economic impact from a community perspective, government, and the person who, like little Lana, is lucky enough to be afforded an intervention. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Lana, one, for sharing your personal story, but more importantly, for influencing and bringing the likes of your organisation and others together for that purpose, which is for the discussion. Now, I'm conscious of time, and under CEDA's arrangements, we always promise to get you out of here on time. It's such a fascinating topic, and I know a lot of you have got questions, so unfortunately, I'm going to cut short the Honourable Peter Freeman for his personal views, but of course, he is open to any questions, so I'm going to now open the floor to questions, because I think we probably have a few.
Hi, Jordan from Business News. Lana, to your point about closing down prisons, and I guess generally speaking, it's not going to be a popular opinion to close down prisons, but I guess generally speaking, these crimes that we're describing are non-violent crimes, they're not crimes that inflict violence on others. Is it worth decriminalising these crimes of poverty, these maybe drug use, sales or burglary, theft? Do you think there's value? And I guess this is open to the broader panel as well. Is there value in rethinking what we think is a crime and maybe changing that as a legal standard?
Thank you, Jordan, for your question. It's quite a controversial one. And at the end of the day, what I will say to that is, regardless of how you perceive crime,
and where exactly, whether it's you or whether it comes from systemic policy change or legislation change. At the end of the day, everybody in the room has a certain gut feeling, and you know there's gut feelings in the judicial system every single day. At the end of the day, my take on the criminal justice system is that sometimes positively, it can be the first time that someone is afforded a positive intervention, support and care. So what I would say is I don't advocate to move the needle and to say if you decriminalise something. What I would say to that is that's actually going to be a barrier to positive intervention. What I would say is not to perceive things like substance abuse for what they are, criminal or non-criminal, is to dig deeper at that point of intervention, that point of arrest, where social justice becomes criminal justice, and say, well, what are the underlying issues? Because I can tell you now, an 18-year-old does not wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to be a meth addict. There is something, there's a journey there, and that's actually where good rehabilitation comes in, and that's what we want to implement. From a business, from even a commercial legal perspective, we can sit here today and say, you know, we will handpick and we'll have tailored person-centric models as an alternative to custody. Whether it be residential rehabs, electronic monitoring, whatever it might be, it's the why from an economic perspective. Why are we doing it? Because when you send, no matter if you deem them hard criminals, soft criminals, victims, then perps, whatever it might be, 50% of the time prison is not working, and we saw the dollar figure attached to that, and that's direct cost only. And if you think about the fact that interventions, really, really good evidence-based ones, whereby you've got great reintegration, custodial type of interventions, if you just move them to the front end, regardless of the category that you or I would like to label them as, if you move them to the front end, you could do a whole lot of the good in that early phase, and you could probably half recidivism, at least in the target group that you've intervened. And that's all we say. Let's just collectively have a crack at that and actually analyse it and evaluate it. Because in the absence of the ongoing benefit analysis and the realisation of did it work or not, how are we as a nation going to scale on the way?
Peter,
well, I don't think a sitting judge should comment on what changes there should be to the law. So I would pass on the question as to whether or not things which are currently crimes should not be crimes. But can I just build on a couple of things that Lana said? And frankly, after listening to Lana and Devon, I figured I felt a little bit inadequate being up here on this panel with them. And Devon, it's Noongar country, you can talk as long as you want. And can I thank you, Ben, for the welcome to the Noongar Whadjuk country that we're on. In terms of the early intervention and the early response, one of the things that those of us who are at the sentencing imprisoning point of the justice system and I suppose, to add sort of the personal perspective, there are Aboriginal men who will sleep in a prison tonight because of an order that I have made or a sentence that I have imposed. So there is a real issue in relation to the timing at which things come in our system. And it is a very... at the moment, because of resourcing issues and so on, a very reactive system that we have. And part of the justice reinvestment programs that people speak to me about all seem to be directed at is dealing with not the acute problems that one might have, but the chronic issues of family dysfunction and community dysfunction that the reinvestment is likely to have its most profound impact. Wendy said, for example, the most important thing that you can have to rise out of poverty and dysfunction is work. which I would wholeheartedly agree. I would add to that family and community. Not just the grassroots communities that are doing a lot of this work at the moment, but there's got to be a way as part of this process to communicate to the community as a whole in this state or in this country why reinvestment to deal with those chronic issues is as significant as it is, because you will always then otherwise be battling conflicting narratives that we can talk about in this room because we're comfortable to talk about in this room, in this company, in relation to justice reinvestment, but that narrative competes with a narrative that looks towards imprisonment as a solution to a whole lot of social problems. So you have to find ways to, in this process, bridge that narrative gap that's going on. And I think having some people like Lana, who's in the game, as it were, people with Serco, helps us to present that narrative in a way that's not going to sound Pollyanna-ish to a large section of the community.
Thanks, Peter. And, it raises the question, well, how does the government, you know, interact with, you know, the business community, the circos of this world, the local communities, the indigenous groups, the women's groups, how do they come together to try and address, to prevent rather than deal with the issues of crime and people at risk? How do we get those groups collectively working together?
Well, one thing I've noticed in some of the programs that I've seen is actually them being very local programs. I'll give an example. There's a group that do a lot of good work down in Bunbury Regional Prison. Uncle Greg Little won the NAIDOC Elder of the Year this year, does a lot of work down there. That was an initiative that was started within that local prison, not an initiative that began in head office at the Department of Justice. And after they'd run the programs for a while, it was then that they began to communicate up the line. And one of the things that I often say to other groups that all seem to be sort of satellite projects that are all doing very different things is that building credibility for the programs is a really important thing in being able to have those discussions that you need to have, as Lana said, centres of excellence where it is possible to communicate in a tangible way the benefits to governments and business and so on. So I think that part of that sort of fostering the experience and the credibility is one of the ways in which the local groups in communicating with each other can help to make those conversations meaningful. Because otherwise people come along and make the presentation and say, that's wonderful, and off you go. And that's it. You forget about them until 6 months roll around and have the same conversation again.
Yeah, I was going to say, share something around the momentum or the home straight that you guys have started and the challenges you've had to overcome.
Yeah, and it's not, your intent is not to plug, but use it truly in a referenceability context. The way that I would answer that, and we've been so fortunate, although we invested a lot of time to get it to that place, long, long story cut short, in trying to develop this alternative justice practice. It was an unsolicited campaign targeting one state in the first instance. And two of them. So we've created a program called Momentum, and it's co-designed with free not-for-profits. Momentum has nothing to do with criminality, albeit some people on the Momentum program would at one point have been criminalised. But it's actually truly an earlier than early intervention. That's the purpose of it. Targeting regional and remote communities and targeting people who, at adults and have no identification, a driver license or a job. And so we link together three not-for-profits, all leaders in those three respective fields. And again, as I said, merely just wanted to integrate the services and achieve the sustainable outcomes that we know will divert that person from a negative criminalised pathway. But the way in which we did it, and the other one was Home Straight, which is a residential rehab, as an alternative to custodial remand. So it's a bit further down in the continuum service spectrum. And for both of those, I say we were so fortunate because we were afforded an opportunity to co-develop with the community, yes, but with government. And what that meant, particularly for Home Straight, whereby handcuffs had to hit the wrist for somebody to be deemed almost eligible for the program, and there was an eligibility criteria as well. But until we got to sit with the likes of yourself and, you know, the bail sergeants and the magistrates who had the ability to say, sitting on remand is not the best thing for you, you probably should see if we can get you into Home Straight instead. To be able to co-develop that from the get-go is going to, we say, we hope, and it's to be determined, I suppose break that cycle of all these seemingly fabulous initiatives whereby there's no uptake and they're not operating at capacity because the true players in the heart of it all, i.e. the judicial system, who are starving for alternatives, but they're not starving for any alternatives. They've got to put the hammer down on something they believe in and that they're confident in. And I say, and we say at Serco with our partners, unfortunately, I think I walked around Acacia yesterday and saw so many people who were not afforded another opportunity because we didn't get an opportunity to co-develop something where you say you have made a decision and people are sitting in prison. But what if there were other things that you actively played a part in and could, you know, have oversight the entire time the person's there up until sentencing? And so that's been an opportunity for the last 9 months with the New South Wales Department of Justice, and it's ongoing, it's not over, and we don't care if it takes 2 years. We'll co-develop for as long as we have to make sure, A, we target the right people, B, we do not put the community at risk, and C, we're actually doing it in a way where we understand the needs of the judicial system, and at the same time, you've got the Department of Corrections sitting in the Department of Justice saying, this is great. You are taking the pressure off us, and we now are the recipients of people who really need to be here. And that's another part, that's another moving part of this, is people can already be on custodial remand. It doesn't mean it's over until sentencing. So they too have come to the table and said, well, this is when we would actually encourage people to reapply for bail because there's an alternative in the region now. So that's been an opportunity and something that we would like to replicate state by state across Australia, and I think that's key to cross-sector collaboration.
Thank you, Alana, and if you need any more information, again, we have some outside. So I think we have some questions from the audience.
Hi, Megan and Will from Hawke Britain. I used to be a criminal lawyer and I used to be a politician. My question, though, more broadly for the anyone really on the panel, hopefully the Chief Justice as well, to comment. I mean, we've got one more state budget ahead of the next state election. All the politicians I talk to seem to be thinking that crime is going to be even more of an issue in this election than perhaps, I mean, we probably all think it's too much of an issue in the past, but there are some signs that it will be a very big state election. My question is more broadly, how do we, as in those of us in the audience, how do we help to, as it were, shore up the political will to do things differently in terms of Justice Mazza's presentation? We can see how ridiculous the spend is for what needs to be spent. So I hope that question's clear, but just what should we all be doing about it, if I could?
Sure. Great question, thank you. I think from our perspective, there's just such a great opportunity to really tackle those root causes that are leading to offending and reoffending. And we look across to the eastern states from our perspective, Women's Legal, where there is much greater support from state and federal government, as well as the private sector in terms of funding for those issues. And so it's not a surprise when you look at the statistics that their statistics are a lot better than WA's. So there's that information already, and we welcome that added advocacy in terms of individuals, corporates, other stakeholders that want to take that conversation and debate to government around funding, but also for our corporate and private sector to really look at what's going on in WA and where they can be contributing in terms of corporate and social responsibility efforts. A lot of the working patterns and things in WA don't make for resilient and connected families, and there's lots of things that we can do there to help with that. And we, again, from the women's legal perspective, looking statewide, know that there's a lot of individual things within communities from a regional, remote and rural perspective, as well as a lot of the issues in the Perth metro area that can be invested in as a strategic initiative, as the Justice said, to actually make a real change to bring an end to some of these things.
Thank you. I think we've got another question. Sorry, Devin, what do I have?
Yeah, probably.
Want some more funding?
I could answer that, look, in a way too that says basically let the government work on maybe taxing the people, you know, for this whole process of justice being given. We tax people for emergency fund, as an example, and all the emergencies go on, but then we create those emergencies.
We create those emergencies anyway through, you know, the practices that we do in society with the global warming event. That's what we should do in this instance, I believe. Any government should just, you know, have the courage to say, well, we're going to tax the people. And say to the people, it's going to work out cheaper for you in the long run. You know, they sell that particular, you know, tax. A lot of us get no choices, but I believe the masses of people, you know, if I was going to run for government, that's what I'd go on, and rely upon the goodwill of the people to say, you know, let's reinvest rather than just have talk fest and put it all on corporate and put it on the community as a whole, you know, because we've got to hold the community I come from and I live in, they want it. We've been wanting it for years, justice for investment. It's, we've been talking about it for since the beginning of time, to be quite honest. And that's what I believe governments have got to do, is really get the courage, that word courage, because it takes a lot of courage to sit up here for me and say what I do and what I've done and everything else. And because a perpetrator or a male that uses violence, being manipulative, will not own up to being that perpetrator, as an example. So the government should just grab some courage, and that's what I say. And if I can sit here in front of you and say what I want from you, so give some money for this, and we can do this, then surely you can recognise that. Because what does it look like, if not in me, what we're talking about? Does that make sense? What does it look like? I don't think society and as a group, we've got no idea what it looks like. We want what we want, but what do we get in return is that process. And this is what you get in return. Is people that will sit up here be on a truth-seeking mission, because you have to tell the truth. And that might be a hard thing for politicians to do, you know, to tell the truth a lot of. And I think, anyway, that's my opinion, not the panel's opinion.
Yeah, I didn't say that,
I think one solution maybe to tax the people rather than say, is it corporate, is it government, should pay. Now this is our responsibility, $53 each time you, I don't know how you work it out, but...
Remember also, and can I just, sorry Lana, to just say one thing in answer to Megan's question. This event's being hosted by the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. It's got the word investment in the name, and we're holding it at KPMG. You might have thought we were here for an economic think tank. And I think part of the messaging is prosecuting the argument that these are economic issues as much as they are social issues. And it's no, I mean, the great irony, of course, whether or not this narrative is true, as a matter of historical fact, it has a nice rhetorical ring to it, which is that in the United States, prison reform got underway by the Republican Party in states like Texas for economic reasons. It was simply costing too much. So I suppose one of the things is that there are different ways of framing a particular approach so that it meets all of the interests that the community has.
You said it much better than I, but stole what I was going to say. But, and I think that is key. I have worked in this sector for so long, and it is deemed at times, and especially in this political sphere, you know, it is left in, is right wing. Our sector is often deemed, oh, that's that soft, wishy-washy stuff that's all about social outcomes, and we need to change the conversation. And we need to have events like this, whereby we know that and we should park that as a fundamental baseline. It's the right thing to do. We are driven socially and emotionally. But the huge politically oriented conversation and driver, however you choose to fund it, and there's innovative and a range of ways to do that, is that it is going to save the government across all sectors. And that's why Treasury departments, as mutual agencies, governing industries and health and justice and all of the different portfolios, need to take the lead here. And they need to say there's a cross-sector benefit here. And economically, that's what really needs to lead the way. And all of us, including Serco, are willing to sign up to outcomes-based modes of contracting. We actually understand that until you, government, realise your social and economic savings made, we will continue to do what we do, and we will not make that, operational cost of intervention. We will not receive it. We will not receive the outcome payments, etc., until we've actually achieved them. And if we do that year after year, economically, this is very difficult to say no to.
And I think it's right. Any of you who have done the research, you will know that in the US and in New South Wales and in New Zealand, the economic and the social impacts are combined. So it's not a political issue. Political just diverts the funds or helps enable. So the actual results come in both ways. So I know we have another question down the front. I'm conscious of time, so please.
My name's Jeff Orr. I'm the Shire President of Shire Deeper West Limited. And I've got my colleague here from Halls Creek, Malcolm Edwards. Listening to you guys has been fantastic, and Chief Justice saying that economic development is a key driver to trying to fix things. The question I'm going to ask Chief Justice is, we tried to engage with the magistrate and find out exactly what sort of parameters the magistrate has when kids or people go up for sentencing. We got a pushback saying, no, we don't want to talk to you. We are not involved in your town politics. That aside, we have come together as a community and all the agencies to try and address the massive spike in youth crime, adult crime, and trying to agree with everybody, and we do agree with everybody, that justice for investment has to happen, infrastructure has to be put in place, and investment has to be made from the government in our juveniles and adults, because it's out of control. Coming together from our community, the question they asked mostly was, how can we, what they did say was that alcohol is the key driver of everything that's happening. And alcohol is, from our, and I'm talking on behalf of the Kimberley Shires, alcohol is the key driver of everything that's happening with the justice system being the end recipient of it. We have decided as four Kimberley Shires to try and curb the alcohol that's going out into the community with the takeaway alcohol management system, having our own alcohol courts and the voluntary perspective. But like I said, the key question that was asked was how can we link the banned alcohol drinkers register to domestic violence? An analogy is like if you get caught drink driving, you should be banned from drinking as well. So, but you can get into a car and you can carry on driving afterwards with a special license. How do we get that that link to the domestic violence and have a consequence for what you do?
Well, I'll respond to that first because I'm picking up the first issue in relation to the engagement of the judiciary and the magistracy in relation to alternative programs. It is in truth a difficult matter to weave between because of the important principle, of course, of the judiciary maintaining its independence in terms of the process, which is part of the reason why, picking up on what Lana was saying earlier, that the building of credibility enables options to be made available to the judiciary in that process. Having said that, I do think there is a role for acknowledging that education in this space and upskilling in this space is across the board, that judges and magistrates need the continuing professional development to know what they should be looking out for as well. You mentioned the Kimberley. A good example, I think, of moves that are in that better direction were only a couple of months ago, 22 judges went up to the Kimberley for 3 days of enculturation with the local community, stayed overnight at a community and met with various groups around the area. Now that's a start, but one of the interesting things about that was that it started awareness of certain things being able to be made available to the courts which people weren't aware that were available. So I think to recognise there can sometimes be a diffidence from the judicial side about not wanting to move too far into executive policy areas which we should not be in, but at the same time acknowledging the need to be continually improving the awareness of the range of issues that we have to deal with.
Okay, I think we've got time for one last question. Back here.
Hi, I'm Jane Anderson. I run in prison restorative justice processes in Bunbury. The question I have is, what I'm hearing is that the state business and industry, they have the dollars, the resources, but if justice reinvestment is place-based and community-driven, how are resources, and I don't mean just dollars, I mean other support, other types of resources be directed at least in part to local communities who I don't think need to be protected from risk, but which have inherent strengths that need to be acknowledged and strengthened. Thank you.
Jane, can I just say that, hand on my heart, I didn't know you were here when I gave the plug for your program that you do with Uncle Greg, so good on you.
I'll just quickly say, and I'll hand it over to other people.
you know, yes, it's only been two opportunities wearing the Serco hats, and although we are creating what we say are replicable solutions, because that's sensible and effective, we would not have a go at anything that is place-based without partnering with local and specialised organisations in the region. Yes, they need to be professionals in their respective field, and yes, we can upskill them if there's gaps in what it is that they're doing today, and I think that's what you mean by resources that are not just monetary. Yes, that's what we're committed to doing, because it's not going to work unless the people on the ground delivering the frontline services, like you say, are local and specialised. And that's just that's one of many expertise that you have, and we recognise that.
We're, in answer to that question, also further to that, we're an Aboriginal community controlled organisation, as an example, and we find it difficult at the best of times, really, any Aboriginal organisation, to get any form of funding, to be quite honest. We have the solutions to the problems, our own problems, only in the Indigenous community, in the Aboriginal community, yet we're not approached, or if we do exist, we sort of, you know, just pushed aside, sort of thing. And we're always on our soapboxes and, you know, shouting from the rooftops and whatever. What we've done moving forward with Aboriginal Miles Healing Centre, as an example, is start off with just, you know, lobbying, as a word. Getting what's available. We went to different organisations, Scott. That had specialists on their team pro bono, as an example, and we've got a team today that consists of probably all the specialists, from engineers to architects to lawyers, you name it, and it's all pro bono. Like I said, pro bono. We've done $2 million worth of work, right? Approximately $2 million worth of work pro bono that's been put into this, into the Aboriginal Miles Healing Centre's concept. And we've out of that, the government so far, the WA government, has given us $273,000 for program development, which we have. So it's about forming partnerships and collaborations and more recognition, I believe, from dominant cultural mainstream services, because all the mainstream services that exist, not-for-profits, are always targeted for funding. And they've got the capacity, because they've built themselves up over years, like you've got Centre Care, Community Care, you know, those organisations like that. But when you get an Aboriginal community organisation that starts from scratch, from the ground up, and then it develops its own board. We got all the board members are all Indigenous. I went and asked Peter. Sat down with Wayne Martin, the judge Thackeray. Asked them if they could be our patrons. Yeah, our patrons. And then we got the three top legal minds in this. In this state, as an example, and you think, you know, that the government would be knocking down the door saying, "Nick, brother, get it happening." They haven't even opened the door for us, really, and you know, that's how it is. That's the difficulty of it. I even reached out to Sister Lana. Hey, she said, "Can we form a partnership around justice reinvestment, as an example?" And that's, there's a difficulties in that, and the inhibitors that belong on that, like your program, it's community, you know, owned. So ownership is important. Ownership is really important in our communities. We own those, you know, you've got to own if you are a perpetrator, whatever it is. If you don't own it, then you're going to be dependent on somebody else to fix it, which is what happens now. That's why you've got recidivists. That's my opinion. Because somebody else is fixing it for them. And they can manipulate that till the cows come in and get whatever they can out of it. A lot of them get some good stuff out of it. That's why they like it. But if you give it to the ownership from the ground up, then they can't manipulate it. Because they've got to own it first. So, yeah, that's my response.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very conscious of time. I'm sure we could speak the rest of the afternoon on the topic, but we do have to let you wonderful people get back to some of your commitments, and I really want to thank the panel for sharing some personal